morning, folks. I'm Tom Ivester, an alcoholic. Member of the Primary Purpose Group in Southern Pines, North Carolina. Got rather gently nudged into Alcoholics Anonymous Groundhog Day 1957. And by the amazing grace of God working in this program, haven't had a drink since. And I am deeply, deeply grateful for that. I'm delighted to be here. It's really good to be back in the Panhandle. Now, I'll talk as long as I can and as fast as I can. It probably won't sound like it, but it'll be about as hard as I can go. And try to get as much told as I can. I tried to fly into Chipley, but all the flights were full. And so I wound up settling for Fort Walton. I'm in no hurry, but Delta seems to be, so we've got protection on the other end. Really, I was thinking about that tape business. That, that's the strange thing about our program and how it emerges over the years. About anonymity. I was at a professional meeting. Wasn't Amy. I was at a professional meeting a while back, and we had a coffee break. And I was just sort of strolling around chatting with a young lady, and suddenly she said, "Are you Tom I?" I already told her full name, rank, serial number, where I live, kids, wife even. And I said, "Well, yeah, I am." So she told me that she'd been listening to tapes. And I thought, isn't it a strange commentary when in an anonymous fellowship, your anonymous identity becomes known better than your real identity? So I have to use my full nomenclature to stay anonymous, I guess. I really am glad to be here. Good to see a bunch of old friends. And sorry that I get to spend as much time with some folks as I wanted to. But it's a real pleasure. I want to thank you for the country roundup and the obvious work that's gone into it, the spirit that's gone into it, and hope very much that you will keep this going, because there's just a vital place for these good down-to-earth places where folks just kind of take care of each other. There's a special kind of loving interaction that occurs, and the more intimate the gathering, the more clear that is seen. And so I'm just delighted to be here, delighted to be in your midst. Let me just sort of remind myself and perhaps you at the same time why we're here. You know, what is it that we're dealing with? And it's been an excellent conference up to now. And Vernon kicked us off, and Juanita got us banging right on in a joyful kind of way. And Tom, a powerful message. My buddy from California, Clancy, an excellent talk last night. And so the message has been carried profoundly. And I just want to remind us, may not be necessary, but I want to get my own frame of reference about why we assemble here this morning. What is it that we gather about? And we're here to deal with a killer illness at a personal level, a killer illness. And I don't think it can be overstated how much a killer illness it is. My buddy said last night that it's a fact, I believe, that better than 90% of the people in this world who have this illness die of this illness tragically. Most of them with never having an actual knowledge that there's a solution here for them. Hearing the words AA and hearing the address of AA or the phone number of AA isn't knowledge of a solution. And the overwhelming majority of alcoholics go down, tragically. So we're dealing with a killer illness. We're dealing with an illness that takes most of us down, and even after we get exposed to the fellowship, it's a rather grim statistic that we seem to look at. Now, we're hard to count because we, drunks are just hard to count. We won't be still. Drunk or sober, we are hard to count. But the best I can tell from what I've observed and what I've heard, what I've read, the numbers are staggering. Pardon the pun, but the numbers are staggering. Never mind the number of people who come through the doors of Alcoholics Anonymous. My God, that's a carousel of tragedy if you've ever seen it, with the number of people who are sent, delivered, drummed through the doors of alcoholics. Never mind those. Start with the number who decide to try this program, who decide to try it. Not the number who are exposed to it, but the number who decide to try. And of those of us who decide to try, the best we've ever done is about 50-50. About 50-50. And that's pretty doggone grim statistic when you look at this illness, and that's what I like to think about. I'm absolutely convinced that we would have a better chance with most forms of cancer than we would with alcoholism. Leprosy. We're dealing with a killer illness. That's bad news. But let me tell you the good news. What we're sitting in here this morning may not be any news to you, but we're dealing with a solution that's more powerful than the illness. And thank God for that. And that's an absolute fact. We're dealing with a solution that will work under any circumstances for anybody who will give it an earnest try. And I know that to be a fact. Know that to be a fact. Millie reminded me of... Where's Millie? Yeah, Millie reminded me of a thing. I just mentioned this and be enough foundation. She reminded me of a thing that she said we met last up in Jackson Mill up in West Virginia. And after that conference, Millie, the next week I was speaking at a group down in North Carolina. And a young fellow came to me at the meeting in North Carolina and said, I was with you last week in Jackson Mill, and I didn't get a chance to talk to you. And I said, well, I'm glad to see you. And I said, let me assure you that I don't speak at every meeting. It'll be okay to come back. We do have others. And he said, no, that's not the point. He said, I wanted to thank you for something that you did. And I tell you, you get your undivided attention when you tell somebody that. And so I said, tell me. And he said, you mentioned, at that reason I knew it was 12 years, is that he mentioned that I had, in the course of my talk, indicated I'd been sober since my first meeting, and that was 30 years at that point. And he said, I can't begin to tell you how important that was to me. And then he told me about himself. He had 11 months in the program. He was from Pittsburgh. And he said, I was honest to God beginning to feel twerpy that there was something wrong with me because I was the only guy who was not going in and out like a yo-yo. And he said, boy, did it ever mean something to me to learn that you actually can grab this elusive brass ring called sobriety and hold on to that sucker for a brand new way of life. Thank God for that fact. It's a powerful program for a powerful illness. It doesn't mean that tragic slips don't happen. But I'm here to tell you that unlike the popular press these days, there's a thing you hear said sometime that you even hear it in Alcoholics Anonymous. I think it's really a product of the treatment industry. That slips are an inevitable part of alcoholism. That slips are an inevitable part of recovery. And folks, that just ain't right. That just ain't right. I think you don't hear a lot about people who stay sober from their first meeting because we tend to feel like we would come across as gloating or being above those who don't have that experience. But I'm here, I told that young man that day, I didn't tell him, but I told myself that day that I would never tell my story again without telling that experience because it is my experience. And my God, is it ever the best way to go? Talk to somebody who has had the damnably difficult experience of going in and out of this program with ever diminishing hope and then finally, sometimes, grabbing hold of it. I guarantee you they'll tell you a lot more profoundly than I would. That no matter what it takes, for God's sakes, hold on. Hold on. Because the odds of coming back after establishment in Alcoholics Anonymous are remote at best. So, with that backdrop, let me get going. I'll miss my flight. I swear I'm going to have to take my coat off. It is just warm. And I was going to try to keep it on, but God, no, where's the country roundup? I would unbutton my sleeves, but they're too long and they flap over my hands. So that's who we are, and that's enough of that. There are a lot of theories about alcoholism. Everybody's got one. And I'm not going to bother with any of mine, except one. There's one I like particularly. There is a theory, a school of thought, that alcoholics are generally people who tend to be a little above average. That we're just a little keener, a little sharper, a little more intelligent, a little more creative, a little more innovative, a little more imaginative than the average cat. I've heard that a lot. I've never heard it anywhere except in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. I don't think anybody over at Florida State is doing brain research to see where the extra chromosome is. But there's enough evidence of that to give, not proving it, but there's enough kind of visible evidence of that to lend a little credence to it. You know, that, yeah, I was a guy that, I'm not going to tell a whole bunch, I'd love to tell a whole bunch of drunk stories. God, I love drunk stories, especially mine. I just absolutely love those things. But I'm going to deny myself for that pleasure. I'm a guy who sort of typified what causes that thinking, I think. I went in the military when I was just a kid, a real doofus kid. And I mean, about as eight ball of soldiers I've ever seen. I tell you, government evaluations are questionable at best. I went through training with 1,000 people. At the end of training, they selected 5 people as having outstanding leadership ability. And in front of the 1,000 men, they started calling names, call mine. God. I said, huh? Now, I knew better. And they sent me off to leadership training. I was supposed to go to OCS and become an officer and gentleman. And by the time I found leadership school, I found town. And they learned that they had made a terrible mistake. 38 months later, I was at OCS, but I was there with the job title of yard bird. Funny, the ironies of fate. In the city of Charlotte, the largest city in our state, I was elected salesman of the year 1 year and fired the same year. Yeah. We seemed to be a cut above. I was the kind of guy that if I went to try to get a job somewhere, I would normally get hired for a better job than I was looking for. I'd go in looking for a grunt job and it won't hire me as a supervisor. I don't know if it's that manipulative alcoholic style or what, but it's always been a characteristic. People always overrate me. I swear I've operated over my head so much I get air sick, man. But that was it. I mean, that was just that thing. Yeah, I really think a guy I worked for one time sized it up well. He said, Tom, you're the best employee I've ever had. 3 days a week. The rest of the time, man, you dead meat. And so it was that sort of thing. I had to run wide open just to stay even. As I looked brilliant in bursts. And then it would bust. I'll tell you about my own alcoholism, and I'm not going to get into a whole bunch of causation or what happened. It comes from a lot of places. Now, every one of us in the world experiences the stuff of life, some of it very good, some of it aversive, and all of it has its impact. We either respond to it and grow from it, or react to it and are negatively impacted by it. I'll just identify one thing. You know, I'm somebody who believes that defects of character, when I first came to the program, I thought it was referred to naughty behavior. You know, I didn't understand that defects of character have to do with the disorder of my being. And defects of character were born of the things that developed for me when my reactions to life. You know, as I started to experience the things of life, rather than responding to them, growing from them, I reacted to them, and I developed some coping survival skills that were not nice, but very effective. I formed a constitutional dishonest nature. You know, I would lie instinctively about anything. And I'm still an instinctive liar. You know, if I get caught in a tight, I guarantee you, my first instinct is not to tell the truth. My instinct's to lie like a dog. Somebody would wake me up in my own house at 3 o'clock in the morning and startle me and say, what are you doing here? I would come up with a story that explained why I was there. Now, it has to be a deliberate practice when I tell the truth. Getting a little better at it. But that's just one. Yeah, I want to just focus on one. There's one that you hear over and over and over in Alcoholics Anonymous about this kind of awkward relationship we have with people in the world about us. Let me just identify one characteristic that I think was fundamental to my alcoholism and critical in my recovery from alcoholism. A thing called isolation or self-centeredness. Self-centered isolation based in fear. It is an absolutely eroding, corroding quality in a life. And I think was fundamental to my alcoholism, this thing of isolation. I was an isolated, separated, miserable kid before I ever knew what booze was. It wasn't my isolation was not a product of booze. When I was 16 years old and started taking meaningful booze into my body, it magically, reliably relieved that isolation. And rather than being the guy who, to an observer, I wouldn't have looked isolated. I looked like a noisy, cut-up kind of a guy, life of the party kind of guy. Not so. I was the kind of guy who would never let people close to me. I would never let anybody know me. When I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, until well after I was in Alcoholics Anonymous, not a person in this world knew me, none. Wouldn't let anybody get close. Always interesting to me that I found it extremely difficult to accept help or gifts from people. Because when you accept help or gifts, what happens? You have to get next to you. And so I lived in that kind of exquisite privacy of isolation. To an observer, it wouldn't have been apparent. It wasn't apparent to me, but I think it was critical to the development of my obsessive reaction to alcohol and my alcoholism. So when I started drinking meaningfully at 16, that thing absolutely dissolved and resolved the problem of isolation in my life. It melted away the bars, the barriers. And it wasn't a problem. It was an immediate, enormous solution. The best solution I've ever found in my life, and the cheapest, most reliable, most predictable that I ever found in my life. And it just freed me. It freed me from the emotional prison of my life. It just turned me loose to go engage in life. I not only was able to mix in the crowd, I took over the sucker most of the time. It just gave me what I needed. And I immediately drank too much with the alcoholic logic that more of course is better. Was not an alcoholic. I got drunk a lot, passed out a lot, went to jail a lot, wrecked cars, lost jobs, was not an alcoholic. I was a guy who found a euphoric solution to a problem. I'd have been stupid not to have used it. And I'll let you in on a little secret this beautiful Sunday morning in Chipley, Florida. If I could have done that, even with moderate impunity, I would be doing it today. Doing it today, because it was an absolutely marvelous solution, and I loved the circumstances in which it was done. It was not to be the case for some reason, and I don't fully understand why. I know probably more about it than I'll talk about. But for some reason, I was one of those for whom alcoholism was in the picture. I crossed, as we say, crossed the line somewhere when I was in my 18th year. Had not a clue at the time, had not a clue until I was sober for a good while in Alcoholics Anonymous. But in looking back and evaluating what happened, I can recognize that along in that period is where my drinking changed. From wild, celebrational, release, escapist kind of stuff, fun stuff, it changed. I changed from somebody who was relatively proud of how much he drank to somebody who was sensitive about how much he drank. I started lying about my drinking in reverse. I used to exaggerate it before. I started to minimize it. I started to get on extended drunks. I started to have periods of time, hours at a time, of which I had absolutely no recollection. Blackouts. Not passing out, blackouts. Just absolute curtain falling, no recollection. Started drinking in Charlotte, North Carolina one night on the main street of our city, the last conscious recollection that I had. I woke up the next morning at the foot of a cliff in the mountains of North Carolina. And you know, drunks can be incredibly motionless. You know, I came to my senses, I looked out the windshield, and I thought, how on earth did I do this? My God, I must have flown. You know, God must have landed me gently down here. And then I bothered after about 10 minutes of analysis of how the centrifugal force didn't destroy me. I looked out the back window. Hell, I drove up. You know, that's all there was to it. But I'm 100 miles away. And I have absolutely no recollection. That's what I'm talking about. And my life became characterized by that kind of stuff. Not every time, but more often than not. Yeah, I would start out to have a few drinks with the guys, wind up in some bizarre, unpredictable circumstance. And I'll only describe just one little thing about that. When I first started reading the book, and there's a place in there, I don't know exactly where any of it is, but there's a place in there where Bill uses the term pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And when I first read that, I thought Bill had waxed a little eloquent. Because I thought, Jesus, that's not what. What is that stuff? Well, hangover, that's not pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. But over time, God, did it ever become crystal clear to me that that's exactly what my life became. Because typically, that's what would happen. Start out to have a few drinks with the guys, wind up in some bizarre circumstance, jail, wrecked car, wrong state, married, for God's sake. Who knows what? Crazy stuff. And every time I would wake up and take a look around at the most recent wreckage of the past, my response would be essentially the same. Well, you've done it again. You've done it again. You're no good. And then would proceed the moral whipping. You're just worthless. You're just worthless. And then that pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization as I'd sit on the side of whatever I had, the curb, the bed, the cell, whatever. And consider my alternatives. Why don't I just end it all? That's real celebrational drinking, sitting there, a young fella, considering just ending his life because of the travesty it's become. Pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. Why don't you just keep going? Don't even go back. Just go on and disappear into the sunset somewhere. Or do I suck it up one more time and go back and apologize one more time and deal with one more failure and one more disappointment? Pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. You know, that bottom was an elusive term to me when I first came into Alcoholics Anonymous. My God, I hit bottom innumerable times. But bottom doesn't mean much unless it's closely associated with the emergence of a solution that's known to me. Otherwise, I reach out to the only solution that I know anything about. That life might have looked miserable, but even though I didn't think it through, what it represented to me was a warm, safe womb to return. I knew the ease and comfort of a few drinks. I didn't know the void. There's an old term you hear sometimes about the battle in the mind between the devils you have versus the devils you may get. And that was very characteristic of what was going on in my head, the devils you have versus the devils you may get. I heard a definition of bottom just recently that just rung a bell with me. It said, bottom is where you are when the unknown looks better than the known. How true. How true. Well, and that's what my life became. It was not whoopee time. This was devastation time. And I just very quickly disintegrated. That was sort of a social wrecking ball. My alcoholism happened so quickly and so devastatingly that I was in past the point of no return before I even knew I was in trouble. Now, all I have to do is look at two extremes. I looked at the fellow bounced out of high school and up in a little town in North Carolina, and then look at the fellow 8 years later who was matriculated up to Michigan following some lark, I don't know what. Wound up in the city of Flint, Michigan. I guess I'd just gone where that's where drunks went for some reason, and I went with them. In a city of 500,000 is where I crashed and burned. That's a General Motors city. It used to be. They're all moving out now. Now it looks like Warsaw right after World War II. I was just up there last week, so I was vividly reminded. That's where I went. And that's where it came unglued. I worked everywhere that I could get a job until my reputation got in front of me. And I wound up in a city of 500,000, unemployed, darn near unemployable. In my last year of my drinking, I prayed God that I never forget. I never want to forget the devastating impact of alcoholism in my life. I never want to forget that absolute meaningless existence of wandering the face of the earth with no place to realistically call home. Never want to forget that. Never want to forget that constant feeling of shame, humiliation, fear, loneliness, disgust, absolute, just total loss of self-esteem, self-respect, worth. Never want to forget that totally meaningless existence. Never want to forget. Never want to forget what it was like to look at myself in the mirror and just gag at what I saw. 21 years old and just wished it were done. Never want to forget what it was like to, I'm not proud of what I did during that era. I don't really look at it as criminality. I'm not really a criminal per se. I've never been somebody who planned crimes. I'm just somebody who lived in environments where, it's really a part of the food chain. I mean, it wasn't real crime. It was just a matter of who ate what day, some days I was friskier and I ate, and the next day the other guy was friskier and he ate. Now, I'm not going to look up any of those folks to make amends. That was just the way it worked. And if you weren't willing to play that game, you didn't have any business there. But I never want to forget that. I never want to forget what it was like to hustle and rob other drunks and junk like that. That was not my way, but that's the way the world I lived in was, and so I adapted to the environment I lived in, of course. Pussycats don't survive in jungles. So, yeah, I'm confident that my life would have come to an end quickly. That people who drink like me don't drink long. They don't drink long. They can't. There is absolutely no way you're going to have a long drinking career with this kind of a pattern. And I didn't have that to be concerned with, though, because my drinking came to an end, I hope. And pray, in a tragic way, not in terms of what happened to me, but in the sense that I wound up doing the kind of thing I think every alcoholic in the world fears doing. Thank God most don't. Most drunks' greatest fears are just that. They're just bad dreams. But sometimes they become very real nightmares. And it was my case. Woke up in jail one morning in Flint, no novelty to that. That was one of my most frequent addresses. No novelty there. Guy walked by, jailer. I knew him, and I asked when I could get out. Normally, he'd say 10 o'clock, and I asked him, and he said, I hope never, and walked off. Had not one clue what he was talking about. Then some of the other guys in the tank told me that the night before, I'd been driving somebody's car down the main street of the city, blind drunk, blacked out, ran down and killed two people. And my reaction was I'm not a subhuman. My reaction was much like anybody's would be, I suppose. Just absolute shock, inability to accept it. The mind protects itself. It only takes in what it can handle. And my response was just to push it away and then gradually accept the truth. The only time I'd ever been in jail, didn't try to get out. And then somebody worked at that jail, found out that I had family in North Carolina, contacted my mother, and she made what was to be her last trip to anybody's jail to get her little boy out. It wasn't her first one, but it was to be her last one. She died some 29 years later with great deep, deep gratitude for a program that had given her a son for 29 years of whom she was extremely proud. Very, very high on my gratitude list is that. Well, I didn't know how to tell her. I didn't want to get out of jail. I was ashamed to get out. I couldn't deal with getting out. I knew I would never drink again. My God, anybody will tell you that if it gets that bad, you'll quit. Don't you believe that? Yeah, we're dealing with a killer illness, not a bad habit. That was the least likely time that I would ever stop drinking, of course. Stayed sober a day and a half, and then from July to November of 1956, I drank literally like nobody I've ever seen. I have worked with thousands and thousands of alcoholics over the last 42 years. I've never worked with one like me. I held an alcoholic in my arms as he died, and he wasn't an alcoholic like me. Because even as he died, he continued to protest that he wasn't like us and died. I just gave in. I mean, my God, a wino could have diagnosed me a mile away. I just gave in to the condition and wandered around. And it was clear, obvious that I was trying to bring myself to death. That was apparent. And obviously it didn't happen. November the 19th of 56 was the day I hope and pray was my last drink. I don't count my recovery from there because the sheriff handled that for me. It wasn't my option. That day I became confined, and I finished my last drink, a bottle of gin, about that much in it. Finished that, went to court, 9 o'clock in the Genesee County Courthouse, tried on the charge of manslaughter. My lawyer entered an eloquent plea. It was to stand mute. How more eloquent a plea could you find for a blacked out drunk? I couldn't even tell them what I'd done. They had to tell me, and I was, of course, found guilty. That day, sentenced to a max of 15 years in Michigan State Penitentiary. Now I hustle around the street with a lot of guys that were in and out of that joint, and I knew that it was not Disney World. I had no illusions about that. And I had an instinctive reaction of fear, but the most real sense of relief I'd ever known, because I knew it was over. It was over. Not optimism or hope or any of that. Didn't even enter the equation. Knew it was done. Next day, walked into that place. Well, our stories do disclose, in a way, what we were like, what happened. They interweave, though, don't they? There's not a clean departure point because, what I want to specifically kind of point out for some reason, what happened. What happened. And because I think it's so critical to recognize that alcoholics don't recover just because they wake up one day and make wonderful decisions. That's pretty apparent, isn't it? that most of us recover. And, you know, when I think about what happened, I'd like to just kind of report it instead of just walking you through it, but I'd like to just kind of report what happened. Well, all of the above happened. You know, every one of those trips of pitiful incomprehensible demoralization happened. Every one of those embarrassments and humiliations and things that happened are part of what happened. But that side of it isn't adequate unless it's married to the introduction of a very real solution. And so what happened this time that made it different? One was that I was put into a place where I was protected from myself for a while. That was important. Yeah, I went in with a 15-year sentence. They kept me there 3.5 years. I never got out of maximum custody. And it wasn't because I was a depraved gangster. My history was so bad, so erratic, that they knew, and I think appropriately knew, that, man, I wouldn't last a hot minute till I got an AA. Well, what happened? Walked into that cell, resigned to my fate, never believed I would ever come out of there alive, and truly did not care. And I'm not talking about cynical, callous disregard. I'm talking about just, I was done. I was beat, absolutely beat. Put me in the cell, didn't speak to a soul unless they asked me a direct question. I didn't engage in conversation, didn't socialize with anybody. I just sat there, read anything I could read to keep from thinking. And one day a guy called me out for an interview, a little social worker guy from, real rookie. I don't think he knew much about much. But certainly not alcoholism, but he knew I did. He called me out, went over my case with me, and lots of people had done that. He made the same diagnosis that I'd heard all of my life. And it always went something like, my God, you sure drink a lot. You're an alcoholic. You're drunk. Why don't you do different? I'd heard that all of my life by every ilk of caretaker. I had never heard anybody describe a solution. Now, AA, it was, you know, we were 22 years old when I came in. We had about 125,000 members, something like that. I don't think it was well known. It certainly wasn't to me. I'd never heard of it in my life. I never heard of anybody even helping a drunk in my life. And this guy got through with his observation that I had a problem. Then he said something I never heard. He said, we have an AA group here at the institution. Think you better go. That's exactly the way he put it. It wasn't an order. I didn't have to go. It certainly wasn't an invitation. Just said, we have a group. Think you better go. And I walked into my first meeting, February 2nd of 57, just like you were at your first one, I'm sure. Not a clue what to expect, just as well. I wouldn't believe it anyway. And I'll tell you what else happened. You know, I'm somebody who I've got some fairly strong feelings about a number of things, and I'll try to talk about it just a little bit before I get on the plane. But let me just indicate a little bit this way. I'm somebody who is a great believer in the power of well-ordered, purposeful groups. Now, I'm not in anti any gathering of alcoholics that meets to seriously take a look at the solution. I'm not against that. But I don't take them too seriously. You know, those little lightweight, casual meetings that have no structure, no depth, and no organization, they're okay. They're nice places to visit. But be careful about living there, because they just don't tend to have the depth. And you know what our book says? That frothy emotional appeal won't get it. That it requires a solution that has depth and weight. And so I'm somebody who believes in the power and value of well-ordered, purposeful groups. Thank God the one I went into at Jackson Prison was an excellent group of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I mean that. By any standard, by any comparison, an excellent group. And I will ever be grateful for that. See, I was the kind of guy, I don't know about you, but I was very cynical about beliefs of any kind. I didn't believe anything I didn't see. Words didn't have an ounce of meaning to me. I believe what I see. And so when I saw that group, here were a group of alcoholics like me who weren't acting like me. These were responsible people who said they were going to meet on Saturday at 1 o'clock. By golly, they met on Saturday at 1 o'clock. They said they were going to have literature. They said they were going to have a beginner's group. They said they were going to do service work. They did every ounce of that. And part of the trust that was so vital to my early recovery and continued recovery was in part of what happened, was that I walked into a group that had integrity, design, and purpose. Did a wonderful job of helping mystified newcomers see that there truly is a design for living that meets every test of logic here and produces the miraculous. Always be grateful for that. Man who spoke at my first meeting that day was a man by the name of Shy Walker from Kalamazoo, Michigan. He was a little short guy. No offense, Bill. Bob. A short guy. Wonderful fellow. One of the absolutely fine members of Alcoholics Anonymous I ever met. He was the area delegate, a state delegate then, so they only had one. I didn't know what that was, of course. I didn't know what he was when I heard him talk. I'd heard a lot of drunks tell stories, but never one like that. I mean, that one had to be true. Nobody gonna make that junk up. That was bad. And I sat there absolutely bamboo. Why would he do that? He's a nice looking fella if you didn't get too close. And here he is on a Saturday afternoon in there telling a god-awful story to 300 crazy convicts. I mean, I have absolutely no connection. That brother's keeper philosophy had not been in my world for a long time. And yet I went back to the next meeting. For 3.5 years I lived there, never missed a single meeting. And I'll tell you this in terms of what happened. Thank God I received the message from, you were talking about Clarence, I didn't get it from some beat-up, angry old goat that conveyed the illness. I got it from a guy who was dynamically, vibrantly, enthusiastically alive. What a powerful, powerful message. Now, I didn't identify with anything about that man then or ever, really, in terms of experience and makeup. He was a different man than me. But the magical quality of his enthusiasm is what brought me back to my second meeting, no question, and to several more for several months. Thank God for that man. He became my first sponsor, and I loved him dearly. Great guy. I'll always be grateful for that. I'll always be deeply grateful for that this group was one that was committed to action. To action. Action as a group. Action as an ethic. Action as a personal part of recovery. And I got pushed into action before I even knew there was an option. I really, honest to God, didn't know that there was a spectator class. They never told me. And so I got pushed into it. And I'll tell you this, I will always be grateful for that. Let me just mention one time back to that isolation thing. You know, I really do believe that isolation is fundamental to the illness and critical in the recovery. For this reason, you know, I mentioned that in my case, my isolation was not caused by alcohol. Well, if it wasn't caused by it, it was relieved by it for a while, but it wasn't caused by it. And if it's not caused by it, it isn't going to be relieved by the absence of alcohol. So stopping drinking didn't have any positive impact on isolation. It probably made it worse. And some of my most excruciatingly lonely times, separated times in my life, have been spent inside meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous. Now, part of what you hear talked about by many people, wasn't my experience, but you hear it talked about by many people, is how powerful the therapeutic value was of coming in to a group of warm, loving people. Of how much it meant when somebody came up and shook their hand sincerely and hugged them. Now, I didn't want anybody hugging me in there. But I don't think I'd have been much different anywhere else. Yeah. See, that's a critical thing in Alcoholics Anonymous, isn't it? Feeling the warmth and feeling the unity, feeling the bonding of being part of this group. This is essentially a social kind of phenomenon that we have here. And to people who are isolated, contrary to what it may look like, warm, clingy, loving people are not highly attractive. They can be more threatening than attractive. It took me a long time to start comfortably holding hands to say the Lord's Prayer. It's a little too close. It wasn't done much back when I first came. It took me a long time to start comfortably, lovingly hugging a man. And it wasn't fear of latent homosexuality. It was the problem of isolation. So rather than seeing that, to me it's awfully important, you know, to be able, we don't have to be psychoanalysts, but to recognize that everybody is not going to immediately jump in and feel part of the gung-ho team spirit. There are some people who need to be pulled into this a little bit different. Now, it doesn't require too much sensitivity. Maybe just that little intuitive knack of recognizing it that we tend to have. I tell you, the quickest way to deal with it that I've found is with action. Action. Physical action. Actually doing something. It doesn't require working on it, fixing it, understanding it, none of that. And typically, if I find somebody to be a pretty isolated guy who's going to hunt a corner, just like I did, what I'm going to do is what folks did to me. I'm going to get them pushed into the point where they've got to interact. I'll put them on greeting. I'll put them in a newcomer group. I don't care what it is. I'm going to put them in something where they physically action, because what I found to be true, in my own case and in every case I've ever worked with, is that if, Phil, you came to my home group, and I made it a point to see that you felt welcome in my home group, you would probably feel better. And the thing is that I would feel even better. And the cure for isolation isn't to be understood, it's to get past that thing. And, you know, I'm not a naturally outgoing person. I'm not a gregarious guy. I'm not a fun, you know, fun kind of let's get it on gang. That's not my instinct. That's my practice. And I do that because I know the misery of isolation. And I refuse to be isolated in Alcoholics Anonymous. I refuse to participate in meetings of Alcoholics Anonymous that are not warm and welcoming and friendly. I don't care if I'm the only cat in there that's warm, welcoming, and friendly. I'm not going to let my lifeline get frayed. Very, very important. So an easy thing to deal with, and thank God for that. Nobody ever explained it to me. They just instinctively pushed me where I needed to go. Well, a lot of stuff happened. Let me mention two other things in that regard, and then shut your engine off, Delta. We're getting ready. There's more to it than just sort of having a part of the group experience, bonding experience, an emotional experience, the awakening of some spiritual fire. More to it than that, isn't there? Yeah, because it is a cure illness, and it does require a very strong solution that has depth and weight. And I'll tell you what the critical point was for me. Went to a meeting one day. No, nothing different to be expected. Guy spoke, spent the entire meeting talking about nothing but the fourth step. Went into great value, great depth about the value of the step. Stressed the importance of writing. It got through. And I knew what he was talking about. I've always been a reader. And I'd read everything we had. Didn't have much, but I'd read it all. And so when he got through, I knew the words. But there's a big difference between knowing the words and having it in your life, isn't there? I went back to my cell and said, okay, I'm going to try that. And I sat down on the bed. I meant to write a little story about how tragic life could be and what a victim of circumstances I was and what a wonderful fellow I was if people just knew it. And I was going to write some fairy tale like that, because that was what was in my mind. And I tell you, the mind is a dangerous place if left unobserved. I mean, my God, man, I can believe anything. Get goofy. If I don't have constant kind of open interaction with you to let me see that. Well, I sat down and started to write. I wrote two lines of what I had in mind, and then with no intent whatsoever, all at once the charade was over. It was done. And I had what old Hemingway called the moment of truth, the time when a person comes face to face with themselves, and it happened. Didn't mean for it to, just did. And then with no intent whatsoever, zero. All at once, it was as if the dam broke, and I absolutely had what they call a cathartic experience, I guess. I just absolutely just turned loose of all of the pent-up stuff that was my life, all of my life. My hand flew trying to keep up with the rush of thoughts. When I got through it, I had 3 pages of scribble, barely legible, certainly not fit for print, wasn't written for print. I tell you this, it's the most important day's work I have ever done in my entire life, bar none. The most. Because that day I knew without any question I was an alcoholic, period. Not the young guy, not the whiz kid, not the tragic case. I knew I was an alcoholic, period. That I had a hopeless state of mind and body. And I'll tell you this, I don't believe that it's possible to overestimate the value of that experience, because I knew at a cellular level that I was beat. Not that I had thought it over and the consequences were too great. Not that it had caught up with me. Not that I'd been in jail all my life. None of that. That I was somebody who, if I drank, my life absolutely fell apart. And the issue for me was not that I have wised up and will not drink. It's recognizing at depth that I cannot drink. It simply isn't an option for me. Alcoholic insanity is an option. Drinking is not. Fundamental. I personally, that's what we call surrender. I personally have never seen any long-term, really productive recovery that hasn't grown out of surrender. None. Just intellectual stimulation and rewarding new adventures won't do it. Surrender. I knew that day that I was in deep, deep trouble. That day I became a member of Alcoholics Anonymous in every sense of the word. I became a guy who was here because of that killer illness. I've never varied in that sense. I've never gone to a meeting with any other notion since. Have no illusions about what I'm here for today. Changed the nature of this. I was no longer a face in the crowd waiting for lightning to strike. I was an alcoholic in the action of trying to get well. Dramatically important point. Well, you know, where do you go from that? The thing that I want to sort of race for home on, and I will have to race, is for a lot of years, it takes me a long time to see the obvious. But there was something. I've known for many years that Alcoholics Anonymous is not a quick cure. It sounds a little discouraging in a way, but I know that this program is not about quick fixes or quick answers or snap solutions. And I don't want to be discouraging, but I can tell you this for a fact. In 42 years, I have never consciously solved one single problem in Alcoholics Anonymous. None. And I'll let you in on another little secret that may be just as startling. I ain't working on none. None. Because I don't think that's what it's about. It's about, and I'll tell you what I found, it isn't that way. It isn't about revolutionary new changes. It's about a new way of life. And what I found that really says it for me in far fewer words than it would take me to come up with is a thing in the 12 and 12. Is that ship ringing a bell? it's in the 12 and 12. I'm nothing against the 12 and 12, but it got to A about the time I did. And I've always looked at it as a newcomer. I'm just a book guy. You know. But I'll visit it sometime. One day I was visiting and I saw something that really, really struck me. And it's the most simple looking little thing. I'll try to say it. I'll screw it up, I'm sure. But you can check me out on it. Get a copy of 12 as well. Look in the preface. About halfway down the page, there's an entry that I think explains what happened to me from that point to what Alcoholics Anonymous is about. For this guy. And for most of us, really. And it says this. It says, AA's 12 steps, I believe, something like that, are a set of principles spiritual in their nature. That tells us what they are. They're a set of principles spiritual in their nature. Now here's where it gets down to what I think is magnificent language. And so easy to miss. Which, if practiced as a way of life, not worked, not studied, not written, not analyzed, no. If practiced as a way of life. See, I surrendered the day that I took that definitive fourth step. But that doesn't mean I'm done. I continue to surrender, and I don't walk around with a white flag. But my soul is at peace. There was a hell of a fight, but I lost. Man, I got knocked cold in a mackerel. And it's done, man. I am beat to the toes. And there ain't no fight. And so I just have to practice that principle of surrender. Well, if practice, continue. Not snap solutions. If practice is a way of life, we'll do two things. Well, it doesn't say two things, but absolutely marvelous promises, and I know them to be true. One, we'll expel the obsession to drink. I had an obsession to drink born of the fact that alcohol for me is a magnificent solution. Magnificent solution. I know at the core of my being, just like I'm an alcoholic, how much value I can get in terms of ease and comfort with a few drinks. I know that. So this set of principles of practice and way of life will expel the obsession to drink. Interesting word. Expels what happened to me in the fifth grade. I got expelled. I got pushed out. And I looked it up, and the definition really is kind of interesting. It refers to being pressed out. Pressed out. The set of principles which, if practiced as a way of life, start to press out the obsession. To press out. And when you read our book, you have to be careful, because it when it first refers to the obsession being removed, it makes it sound like a lobotomy. You know, that it's just sort of plucked away. It's gone. That sucker doesn't even exist. Read on, honey. Read on. Because right below that, the reality sets in. You know what it says. In reality, what we have is a daily reprieve, contingent on the maintenance of our spiritual condition. A set of principles that practice as a way of life will push out that obsession to drink. I haven't had an obsession to drink for around 36, 37 years. Did have one when I first came in. I would not be surprised if I had one in Chipley, Florida today, nor would I be unprepared. I'm an alcoholic. Didn't used to be. I'm an alcoholic. Full bore. An obsession to drink is part of the package. I deal with a killer illness, not bad behavior that's behind me. All I have to do is let up on the practice of spiritual principles, and look who's knocking at my door. Expel obsession to drink, and it surely will. And then the next thing, what a beautiful promise, and I found it to be true. Will enable the sufferer, I think it says, to become usefully whole. And I'm here to tell you that's not a hollow promise. That's a powerful promise. To become usefully whole. These steps became a way of life for me in a maximum custody penitentiary. They worked for me as well there, if not better, than any place I've ever been. That's the toughest living I've ever done in my life, the most depraved conditions I've ever experienced in my life. Place where man's inhumanity to man is routine, where kindness is considered weakness. Sincerity is a synonym for stupidity. These principles worked for me there. Went through 3.5 years with dignity, never injured psychologically or physically that I know of. These things worked. I became a free man. Free man. In every sense of the word, except probably the least important. Physically. Physically I was confined, but that's not what confines us, is it? I'd been in a prison all of my life. My God, a tighter prison than that. And I became free because these principles work powerfully. And they'll work for anybody. I don't care what your situation is. I had a good friend in an iron lung, couldn't move anything but his eyelashes. Probably one of the most free people I ever met. Powerful stuff. Powerful. But I'm usually whole. And when these things happen, you know, some marvelous stuff happens. And now, I'm a very practical guy. I'm not a charismatic. Nothing wrong with that, but that's just not my deal. I'm a very practical guy. I'm a deeply spiritual man. I have beliefs that are important to me. But I'm not a mystic. Yeah, I'm a practitioner of the way it's described in the book, that I think it's okay to have your head in the clouds, but keep those feet on the ground. And that's what I try to do. Yeah, what I found, and I want to head for the home stretch with this as quick as I can. When this happens, it's not a matter of what I'm like, it's a matter of what happens. You know, what is it that happens to a life that gets unchained from the bondage of self and the bondage of alcoholism? What is it that can happen in a life? You know, this thing did work for me in that penitentiary. 2 years after I was in there, I was recommended for a special parole. I didn't make it, but I was recommended. What an honor. It only happens once in 10,000 cases. Isn't that something? I wasn't looking for nothing. I didn't know they had such a thing. Of course, they kept it. I got very active, started new groups. I helped start when Narcotics Anonymous first came into being. I helped start a group of Narcotics Anonymous at that institution. It meets to this day. Not as a member, but as where else would NA people get their help out of AA? And so we helped start a group. And it's a very important piece of my little bit of legacy to know that that flag was planted and waves today. Part of that. Somebody invented television while I was drunk. Woke up and there it was. Michigan State University was sending their university program there to anybody that would pay tuition, buy books, and I did that. And enrolled in Michigan State University. Finished 2 years of my college education in that place. Something else, isn't it? Most alcoholics, you don't have to say giddy up to them. You got to say whoa. There are notable exceptions, to be sure, but most of us are fairly compulsively driven people, I guess. And I tell you this, it'd be enough about that. It's a strange commentary, but I think it really underlines what I'm talking about. I hated that place with a purple passion. I really did. I had some idiots tell me I'd get used to it, but it takes obviously longer than 3.5 years because I hated it much more intensely when I left than I walked in. And the night that I was, before I was leaving, I was thinking to myself, geez, I wish I just had one more day to finish up some stuff that I was doing in AA. Of course, I didn't tell anybody. I'm not a soul. I grudgingly left the next morning, man. I wouldn't have given them a second. And it hit the ground. And I tell you, it's been a marvelous thing. If you're solidly established in Alcoholics Anonymous, change is not all that traumatic. It's significant, but it's not traumatic. And so when I hit the street, I was prepared for the next deal. And I plugged into a group, had a major league, powerful homecoming, and immediately took my place in fellowship. God, it's just been a trip. I tell you, it's been a trip. And I want to tell you just a few things, because I know some people would really get on my case if I didn't do it. And I have ambivalent feelings about this, like talking about that being sober from first meeting. You know, every case doesn't have a happy ending. I mean, there are some cases that end in tragedy here in terms of what happens. But I'm here to tell you that there is no limit to what can happen with a human. And you know, when I left that joint, the only thing I wanted to do was just be physically free and to find a place in some town that I could finally just be a decent citizen. Surely didn't have any grandiose notions of anything much beyond that. Just that's all I wanted, just to be out there and be one of the guys. My group was very active in institution work, and the second week I was out, they asked me to go with them over to a prison. I said, man, they won't let me in. They may not even let me out of it. They said, yeah, they'd get me in and get me out. And so I went. Second week I was out, I was back. Wasn't carrying any message, but I was walking in and out of an AA group in an institution. And I was like a pig in slop. I loved that. Great stuff. I was home. In a way, about 2 months after I was out, I was named outside sponsor of that group. It was like Bobby is up at Eglin. What a powerful affirmation. It's not a status thing, it's a work thing. But what a powerful affirmation for a guy that wondered, you know, what would it ever be like. About the same time, pro supervisor came to me one day, said, Tom, very active, and said, hey, thing. Yes, sir. He said, wouldn't it help you if you could drive? And I said, yeah, but I can't. As if he didn't know. And he said, let me check on it. A couple weeks later, he called me and asked me to meet him at the Sears store uptown. And I walked in. Now, I'm not a mystic. Yeah, I believe in miracles, but I've got my own definition of it. I think miracles are what happens when preparation and opportunity come together. And God takes care of the marriage. I walked in that day up at the Sears store where the driver's license agent was. My man was standing back there. I went up to him. He introduced me to the guy that was the license agent. The guy, after we visited a while, handed me a driver's license. Didn't even ask me if I could drive. No test, nothing. Didn't even pay for it. Now, you know that's illegal. I mean, God, man, you can't. Ain't no way you can do that. Well, that's right, too. There is no way you can do that. But there is no limit to what God will do with somebody who gives his life to the simple program. Because the barriers come down. And I don't care what they are. If God's got work for me to do, the barriers will come down. Provided that's what I'm about. If I'd have been trying to con and manipulate that into happening, I'd be walking today. Absolutely guarantee it. Well, elected DCM 5 months after I was out. Tremendous, tremendous sense of gratitude for that. 2 years after I was out, got a call one day from our state capitol, and the man introduced himself. He'd visited one time the AA group that I sponsored, and so I just met him. And he said, Mr. Hivester, we are expanding rehabilitation in our prison system, and we were wondering if you would consider accepting a position. And I swear to God, that was the most foreign. Well, that was foreign thought to anybody. They had nobody done that back then. And I said, "Good God, man, you know who you're talking to?" And he said, "Yep, probably know you better than you know yourself." And he did. And so to him, I said, "Well, I'd rather do that than anything in the world." Than myself, you know what I said? There ain't no way. There ain't no way, man. They never hired an ex-con in history. They ain't gonna start with me. But they did. And so I went to work, loved it, dubbed it just dearly. Still do. I'm still doing it. Long time later. Worked about I might count it up sometime. Somewhere around 8 or 9 years, somewhere there. I was basically a rehab supervisor. I was mud wrestling with the guys and loved that. And then one day the head of our system asked me to stop by and visit with him. And so I went in. He said, "Tom, I'd like you to take an assignment." I'd heard that before. Normally what he wanted me to do is speak at a civic club or do a speech for him somewhere. And I said, "Yes, sir, what is it?" And he said, "I'd like for you to take over an institution as warden." I swear to God, I don't think I've told that 10,000 times. I don't think I will ever tell it without full appreciation of how utterly impossible that story is. I mean, there ain't no way that can happen. Of all the things that a delusional drunk sits in a penitentiary and dreams about, that doesn't even make the chart, you know. And so he said that to me when I got up. I said, "Boss, I don't know if I want to do that or not. I don't want to be the man. I don't want to be a turnkey." And I really didn't. I did have some concern. Now, I'll assure you that nobody, even back then, was recruiting wardens out of maximum custody penitentiaries. There is a lot of truth to that preparation opportunity. I had bothered to finish my education in correctional administration. I wasn't particularly ambitious. I just got tired of being the dumbest guy in the room. And so I really was playing catch-up again, operating over my head. And so I finished my education, correctional administration, and honest to God, outworked anybody I've ever met. And it wasn't ambition. It was just zeal. If there's any extra quality we bring to this thing, I think it's the zeal and the intensity of what we feel. And so I agreed, reluctantly, and for the next 20 years, that's what I did. I was a warden, and my specialty was developing. I didn't say it that way. They just used me that way because I'm that kind of a guy. I've got that kind of an active mind that if I get something done, I immediately turn to what do you do with it next. You know, I don't ever see finished products. I see things in process. And so I became a guy who developed institutions and had the opportunity to develop some brand new innovative things in our system that exist to this day. And so I'm very grateful for that experience. It's been a marvelous experience. Not everybody in corrections has the kind of experience I have, but mine has been characterized by challenge and excitement and real deep, deep sense of gratification, of course. And I share that story not only because of how meaningful it is to me, naturally, but also what it says in terms of the Hope Department, because I know that there are probably people here who are wondering, what next? You know, what in the world could happen in my life? And I'm just here to tell you, no limit. And I'll tell you the strange, paradoxical truth about this. None of this is any design of my own. Now, it's a God's truth. Every significant thing that's happened to me since I got into recovery in Alcoholics Anonymous has happened without any kind of stuff from me. It's just happened. Much of it's happened in spite of me, I think. It's just a matter of what happens. What that thing says, that expel obsession, drink, and lead the life, enable suffering to develop realities and usefully whole. And boy, is that ever true. Otherwise, I'm just I'm an average guy. I've had an extraordinary experience, but I'm just an ordinary guy. I live in a little old town, and I am what I dream to be, and I'm a decent citizen. Pretty good. I wouldn't mind having me for a neighbor. Pay taxes. A lot of them. Willingly. Vote. Every time the door opens, I vote. Sometimes I don't even know who's running. But I vote anyway. But I remember when I couldn't. Got a little gal at my house that I'm married to because I love her and I want to be her husband. We just celebrated 30 years of continuous marriage last year, and something special. A couple of kids that I really thought they were airheads for a long time. I truly did. And I wouldn't have bet a nickel on either one of them. My son looked like an absolute natural for Alcoholics Anonymous. He was really working on it. And I don't know what happened to him. He went bad. He majored in fraternity the first year, and then for some reason, I don't know what happened to that boy. He got interested in medicine and graduated from medical school, and he's finishing up his residency now up in the state of Delaware, delivering little Yankee babies, about a dozen. And my daughter's a psychologist and deals with development, case management supervisor for developmentally disabled people. We're proud of those kids. Now, they didn't inherit any brain power from me, and I don't even think from their mother. What they had the luxury of was growing up in a house where Alcoholics Anonymous principles were in place. If we've given them anything, it's a peaceful place where there was love and nurturing and support, where they could bring their friends without fear of embarrassment or humiliation. Be grateful for that. Well, otherwise, and I'll just leave you with this thought because I do have to go load the plane. I want to bring it back to where I started. You know, that like anybody that gets around the country, Clarence, I know you run into this. There are places in this country where AA is damn near a joke. I mean, it's so far removed from the kind of thing that I was given the luxury of having when I came in, with little old casual meetings that just are thrown together with no real purpose, with answering services that specialize in how to communicate what we will not do. You know, Jesus, I mean, it's amazing to me how we... Anyway, it's just there are a lot of things that I have concerns about. And sometimes I wonder, you know, what can I do? I'm one member, only one member. But by golly, I am one member. You can believe that. I'm one member. And as one member, there's stuff that I can do. One is I can be a good member. You know, when I let somebody know that I'm a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, I want to look like somebody who's got 42 years of successful recovery. I don't want to look like some angry old goat living in the past. I want to be somebody that can be an example of the fact that this brings life and this brings joy and this brings worth. I want to do that. I want to be an example that somebody would seek out, want to be around. I can do that. I want to be careful about how I conduct myself because many times I am the only example they may see. And when they see me, I want them to see that this is a place where a new life really happens and not just an old life tolerated, but a new life happens. I can do that. I can be a well-informed member. Now, I'm not the smartest guy in AA, but I can read. I can become informed about the issues of concern in Alcoholics Anonymous so that I can make an educated contribution to the issues that we're confronted with and not just pop off with some reaction. I can do that. I can be a member of a solid home group, and I am. Some of you have been to my home group, and I guarantee you that's a group of Alcoholics Anonymous. It has purpose, it has real meaning, it has real joy, it has depth, and it has weight. And that's my home group. It's also where I do my most important work. My most important work's not at a podium in Chipley. This is important, but that's not my most important work. My most important work's in my home group. See, I don't care how brilliant I might be or how jazzy I might look as a member. What I have to remember is that I'm not the solution. I'm not the solution. And in order for me to be effective, I have to have a group so that when I get somebody attracted to Alcoholics Anonymous, I've got a place to take them. And my group's that place. I want them to know. See, I took on an obligation, self-imposed, that my obligation to Alcoholics Anonymous is to assure that the next man or woman who comes into a group that I'm in gets as good as I got. How could I justify anything less? So I can do that. My most important work is what I call trolling for drunks. And that's what I do at my homework. I troll for drunks. And I look for people that ain't with it and push them around a little bit and jack them around and just, you know, loosen them up. And mainly just let them know they're in the right place. I can do that. I can do that. I can contribute by my support, by my physical support as much as I can. Is certainly in the support to the areas that go beyond my group, to my district stuff and my area stuff and to general service and to our worldwide efforts. I can do that. And that's what I'm here to do. The way I like to look at it, when I came in, I won't drag you up here to do it, but the way I like to look at it, my own simple way, when I came in, there were 125,000 people. And an old boy reached over and took my hand and said, "Come on, guy, walk with us." I did. And I was 125,001. And then I reached over and took another old boy's hand and said, "Come on, Tiger, let's go." And he became 125,002. That chain reaction of love and service has reached many, many times around this world. And the question that comes to me, and I hope comes to you, is what kind of a link will I be? Am I going to be a link that's a strong, viable part of this chain? Or am I going to be the place where it stops? I hope when you leave Chipley today and you go back to your place, that you'll go back with a fire in your gut to make it the best place a drunk could be.